races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Very good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 219 XM, 201 Sports Zone, 964 if you're listening to Sirius XM online and at the website, stevebick.com. Back from the Hot Springs, Tucson exacta, double. A good way to round out the year, not as expansive. I don't know if we're gonna, can we compare it to, we can't compare it to 2020, of course. So I guess the comparisons have to go back to 2019. We were down. I don't know. Let's say down 15% versus 2019, but up significantly from 2020 for travel. But a good way to end. I pulled up from the last couple days the concept of getting out to California to make it, you know, back. I thought this was the prudent thing to do, and so we'll watch Los Al from afar, and we've got. We got a nice mix of things to look forward to this weekend, in addition to the Futurity. These days it's a grade two, but still a, you know, significant companion to the Starlet last weekend. And then a break leading into Santa Anita. And in fact, when we talk to Hammer tomorrow, he can tell you more about his panel about field size, because a lot of the conversation talked about structure, as Hammer told you. In fact, you were listening just now to the replay, you know, just had a quick quick chance for Hammer to sit and you know, quickly summarize the few days at Symposium, and then we broke, and I hustled to Phoenix. I made it. I got there enough time, actually. They've got that crazy rental car process at Phoenix, but. Yeah, you know, taking the period of, you know, the opportunity to be off essentially until December 26th, it gives everybody a chance to refresh, and you know, that came out during that panel. I do want to get a few more recap conversations and some opinions in. Ideally, don't know if we'll, I wanted to get Nick Tamaro to talk about, not just go over the pick six with me today, the carryover sequence at Aqueduct, but he specifically wanted to sit in on the fixed odds conversation, which was, you know, clearly one of the most important topics, if not most important. Then certainly of great interest, you know, especially in view of, you know, the suggestion from bet makers that, you know, that this can be a volume opportunity that, you know, that keeps, you know, horse racing amongst the forefront of betting options with the sports. And then this is an interesting. The views of this are all over the place, and it seems to be that they're coming to a a rubber meets the road scenario, right? So I'll save this for obviously it was going on while we were on the air, so I can't very well offer too much about what went on. So we'll save that ideally for tomorrow for Nick. There was the decoupling conversation as well, and the couple things that went on actually after I left. I couldn't stay for the for the late sessions yesterday, but we'll get a few more insights in. One thing that I'll touch on from yesterday, and I actually tweeted something as I was flying back. I thought about, I was reading some reactions to the news of the day, the news of the week, and the weekend. Fold in any number of recent headlines, and I don't know if I want to say desire, but the need or the gut level reaction of many to express just desperation and reacting to what feels at times like overwhelming difficulties and challenges. And I understand, I certainly can understand, and after 15 years essentially of discussing whatever whatever topic comes to light or jumps up and creates a crisis, you have to find a way in which you see a path forward, because in the moment, in the immediate, it can feel overwhelming and desperate. So how do you respond essentially, and what is that path forward? And my sense, as I when you're in the air flying and you got time to think about anything, I thought about the three students that joined us yesterday, and as I had said on Tuesday, my eagerness or my anticipation, whenever we go to University of Arizona to the symposium, to have the students on is one of the highlights. And Eric DeCoster, Michael Sanduli, and Haley Schiffer were met with a wonderful response from all of you, and I'm glad. Because what you heard from, you know, from all three of them is very much a you know, kind of wide-eyed eagerness and excitement and, you know, desire to be involved in the game and the industry. And it's funny, on a corollary, I've just spent an hour. I had to jump off of it 10 minutes ago or so to get started on the show, but I've been involved since 8 with the school that I, you know, I went to for high school, Watkinson School in Hartford, and they reached out to me about basically a seminar for their seniors, for people that are involved in sport. And they rounded up 4 of us. I was by far the oldest. That made me laugh a little, but it fits into the same scenario, that of, you know, young people that are hoping to find their way into something that they have passion for. And that's what you heard yesterday from Eric and Michael and Haley. I mean, just this unbridled enthusiasm. And of course that, you know, comes in the face of what, you know, was a week that had its share, obviously, of hard to accept news and, you know, difficulties that expose, I suppose, fissures in the way the foundation of the game is laid. And I'm not sure what led me to make the connection, but I reached out for one of my favorite pieces of literature, which is Candide. And Candide's for those that aren't necessarily familiar with Voltaire, the satiric novel that pokes fun essentially at hope and optimism. It's kind of a pin in the balloon of hope and optimism, but at the same time, it ends actually. The most famous line, the best of all possible worlds, but at the end of Candide, there's an incident or an experience that it kind of brings everything together, where Candide meets an older, the Turk, and an older gentleman and his family, and the Turk provides a lesson, essentially, that being overly focused on I don't want to say the negative, but on you know, on some of the things that appear out of your control is not a worthwhile endeavor, that you're better off focused on the immediate and what you can affect and what you can produce and what you can essentially cultivate. And the line that we must cultivate our garden, I thought was a valuable tenet, as it were, for where things are, that you can only address that what is in front of you, that which you have direct influence. And if everybody does that and has that approach, we've got, I think, a better chance at affecting change positively. Because when you're thinking about all these challenges and concluding that we're doomed and the game can't possibly go forward, it's the end times are in here, if you allow yourself to be consumed by everything at once, there's no way that you're going to be able to successfully navigate your way through difficulties. And this all goes back to that expression that everybody has to be a good steward of the game. And in this case, with this example in mind, cultivate your own garden. If everybody does their job, if everybody focuses on what's in front of them and what they can do well and produce, positive result, then collectively you lift the game at large. So when you've got 4, 5, 6 hours, whatever it is, to travel, and you're just trying to digest everything that went on over the 2.5 days, you try to make sense of it and how can you leave in this case Tucson and go back to what you do and help make things better for everybody, because this is a collective, this is an ecosystem. You use whatever expression you want to describe what racing is, but we're all interdependent. You know, and I saw some things yesterday. Frankly, the proverbial doom scrolling Twitter that just it was really just distressing and just deflating. And it's very important under these kinds of situations to not, you know, not be accusatorial toward, you know, other parts of the game and other regions. I saw one reprehensible, just unconscionable comment that absolutely provides enemies of the game precisely what they're hoping for, which is internal squabble and strife. There's no time for that. There's no room for that at all. So cultivate your own garden. That's the advice of the day. All right, that was as much profundity as I'm capable of delivering today after hours of reflection. Speaking of reflection, to get some news of the day in, saw that Marty McGee reporting that Robbie Alvarado is going to retire, 48, and Saturday at Turfway, the seventh race, that'll be it. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Robbie, who's had, you know, his share of ups and downs, like every race rider, injuries, and you know, you think back to the Animal Kingdom circumstance, ended up providing John Velasquez with his first Derby with Animal Kingdom. But the way in which Alvarado was able to end up with Swiss Skydiver, an excellent, it'll be in retrospect, I'm sure we'll talk to Robbie, ends up being a terrific kind of career coda, really, right? It was very much I think you could say a bit of a surprise the way that that Robbie Alvarado ended up landing Swiss Skydiver and, you know, to win the Preakness and Beholder Mile and more. You go through, you know, it's funny, you go through just kind of whistling through some of Robbie's stake mounts. It's funny how you forget about certain horses that a veteran rider like Alvarado enjoyed, and of course had plenty of success with Curlin and Hot Dixie Chick. I had forgotten actually about Hot Dixie Chick that he rode. Court Vision, Macho again in the Foster, looking at grade ones, a lot of grade ones. Wow, he won a lot of grade ones. Einstein. Wow, in the Woodford Reserve. There, we forgot that. That's got to be with with Helen Pitts, right? Yeah. At that time. Wow. Yeah. Curlin, Swiss skydiver. Einstein's definitely one of his great mounts. Wow, he rode Notional in the Risen Star. I would not have remembered that if you'd given me a head start. Wow, shadow cast in the Personal Ensign. Wow, in 2005. That one I would not have. He rode plenty for Neil Howard, right? No shortage of Neil put him on plenty of nice horses, right? Wow, he really has a mine shaft. Of course, let me talk about Neil. There's a personal favorite, Dr. Kashnikau. Forgot that he wrote Dr. Kashnikau. Wow. Well, Robbie Alvarado, and just looking to see who his first. I'm curious now, who was his first Grade One winner? His first Grade Ones came in 1998 with Joyeux Danseur, who won at that time the Early Times Turf Classic, and Banshee Breeze, the spinster. So Joyeux Danseur would have been his first Grade One winner. And his first stake winner of any kind, Snake Eyes in the Stars and Stripes. Wow. Going back to 1995 at Arlington. Steve Mergulin. Huh. Well, Robbie Alvarado, we'll talk more, I'm sure. We've got a couple of retirement stallion things to talk about with Sid. Well, Sid will be on with us today. We pushed Sid back a day, and we've got a ton to talk about with Sid, obviously. And... you know, there were a couple of things that I did not get to in the crush. Whenever we're traveling, it's always hard, and you lose track of certain things. One thing that I wanted to acknowledge, Pete Fitzgerald, the long time, 4 decades at NYRA, and of course Paddock Judge for I don't even know how long, the last many years. If you didn't see the nice little video that NYRA put up, but Pete retired on Sunday. So best wishes in retirement to to Pete, and some sad news from NYRA and the passing of Melvin White, that another four decades of service on the backstretch at Saratoga. And There was a very nice some very nice appreciations I saw yesterday coming home. About Melvin White. So So many people, you know, they make not just, you know, not just a job and a career, but it's a life. I mean, that's what people like Melvin and Pete Fitzgerald. You get on the racetrack, and that's it. You never leave. Don Capone. It's funny. I thought how could, you know, who could I, you know, reach out to that might, you know, best explain the role that somebody like Melvin White had, and Don Capone came to mind. You know, Donnie was basically the plant manager of the racetrack, of the front side, for 50 years. The only job he ever had. He's been in retirement. He's been working a little bit. I don't know if I haven't seen him lately. We've only gone to the movies once, but he was working over at the Bowtie, the downtown. But the only job that Don Capone had in his entire life was for the New York Racing Association. From the time he was a teenager, and. You know, that one of the real pleasures of being on the racetrack is, you know, meeting and you know, getting to know people like Don Capone, Richie Kolsch, and you know, so many that they're behind the scenes, but they make the show go. We think of the 8, 9, 10 races a day as the show, but there's so much more to it that the underpinnings are just incredible. I mean, what goes into making the racetrack run and function. So, a couple of names that are obviously better known to. You know, some people than others, but had to appreciate Melvin White and Pete Fitzgerald. Sid Fernando standing by to join us, and probably a little bit of extra time with Sid this morning because touched on in the first 15, 20 minutes. The news of the day, the news of the week, and then turn to some of the bloodstock news, including Wednesday's mix sale. Sid, good morning.
Hey, Steve, good morning. How are you? Are you still out there?
No, I came back last night. I flew back last evening.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, I mean the combo trip that we crafted with the Oaklawn and the Oaklawn opening, which was really really enjoyable, and I'm so glad I did that. And then then to Tucson, and as I wrote last night, as a sort of a coda to the experience, it's always worthwhile, and I. I'll let you opine on this, and it was certainly a pointed couple of days in the wake of Monday's tragedy at Santa Anita with Medina Spirit, and it was already going to be a high-profile couple of days of symposium, given Heise's what was going to be their introduction that they were going to provide to a wider audience formally, plus Tom Rooney being introduced as the incoming proxy at NTRA, and we had a really nice conversation with him as well on Tuesday. And then, you know, just the other business elements that are always prominent on the symposium docket. And that included things like yesterday's fixed odds discussion and more. Fixed odds.
Oh, fixed odds. Oh, yeah. In fact, I heard that segment on your show a couple of days ago.
That was Pat Cummings and Nick Tamro.
And
Nick was going to, I was hoping Nick would be available. He's on a plane right now, so we'll do it tomorrow with Nick. But he specifically yesterday, we were hoping, he was supposed to visit with Frank Hopp from Sam Houston, and they were going to sort of, you know, talk about Nick taking over as the track announcer, and we'll be doing plenty of visits with Nick on that front. But anyway, he said, you know what, I really want to sit in on the fixed odds session. So that was on while we were on the air. So I've read a couple of recaps, but I want to get Nick's take, because this is becoming a bit of an important conversation.
Nick's take seems to be Pat's take, if I got that correct.
A little bit, I think. Everybody's, I won't say worried, but everyone's, when it comes to this, the cautionary view seems to be that fixed odds, the bugaboo will be the same as that the big sports bettors are complaining that the fixed odds marketplace will lock out the big winners and limit, you know, put essentially a stopgap limit on successful wagerers. And, that was a part of the Q&A that everybody was looking to, you know, hear an answer. And I don't know if they necessarily got one. I would love to, I'm anxious to hear, you know, some of the thoughts. Nick's view is as valuable as anybody's.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice to hear all the views. ITP on Twitter has some views too. He actually made an interesting comment on Matt Haggerty's article about Matt writing about how they lay off.
Right.
You know, that's how these guys work. But then ITP pointed out, how are you going to lay off 1,000K at 15-1 when the odds are now 5-1? You know, I think that it's a really interesting discussion. It's really not my bag, but I've been intrigued by all the commentary, and I have read up on it. But I think that, you know, they should get these guys all into a room with very varying views. I'd love to hear explanations of that, you know, and just what you brought up too, you know, the stoppage, which is what is the main concern.
Well, given that this concept is coming from, you know, from the people that have executed it seemingly successfully in Australia,
they have success behind them, sure.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a model, and
as you pointed out, it's the tab is kind of maneuvered successfully through it.
Yeah, I mean, and they did it as I won't say to placate certain interests, but once they once they established the ability to put it on the tab offering on the on the app for people, it very quickly and steadily grew and is a bigger percentage of total handle now in Australia and New Zealand. So it's potential.
Oh, I think, it should be explored, sure.
Well, to me, the one part of it that whenever I would have these discussions with Dennis Drazen, and because he, Dennis is willing to try anything, and then of course his willingness to try anything resulted in the biggest change in the history of North American sports. The opportunity to offer the fixed odd option to neophyte players, to me, that was a benefit, that the pari-mutuel system is one of the one of the intricacies about the game that is arduous for those that are learning. The learning curve is so difficult. So having a fixed odd option to lock in a price, and so that if they win, when they go to the window, they get exactly what they thought they were going to get. And my opinion on this was formed, by my dating Tina, her explaining the difficulties for mutual clerks in this case, of explaining to players. This is at Saratoga, where you get a lot of new horse players and potential horse players, and going up and betting at 8-1, winning, and then 20 minutes later, and they don't understand why the horse ended up at 4-1. Why am I getting $10? I thought I was going to get 18. And my principle is that you never want anybody walking away from the window that's cashing a ticket but feeling badly. The experience of cashing a ticket is supposed to be uplifting and thrilling. You don't want anybody walking away disappointed that they cashed. So anything we can do to minimize that is a win.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand your concerns about all this as well. It's very similar with high-speed trading and when it first came up, too. And, I have a very good friend who has a big company that made a lot of money in Chicago at the onset of it. And Pat actually, to his credit, explained this part pretty clearly. These guys are working as investments. They're working to find the inefficiencies in the marketplace, and they're able to make these trades to balance, to make, minimal amounts with high volume, and that's how they make their cash. And, it's very difficult to translate that to racing and its wagering landscape, because we're like driving a Model T versus how things are done, for example, in the marketplace, stock marketplace. And so there's going to be all this outcry and everything. It's just like everything else in racing. The technology has surpassed racing by a long way. I mean, just look at everybody complaining about, from timing to high definition to everything concerned with it. It's all happened as this business has gone from going to your local brick and mortar to punching it on your phone, to the guys now using high speed technology to take advantage of inefficiencies. I mean, so I think it's a huge lag. I totally appreciate your point of view about how the newbies coming in are flummoxed by everything. At the same time, you've got guys like other guys, talking about their own interests, which is they're bigger gamblers and so forth. So it's an interesting discussion, like all things that take place in racing, because racing is really a great case study of a business that's lagged so far behind everything else, and it's trying to catch up.
Yeah, agreed. And any number of areas go to an area, Sid, that is probably more, obviously more pressing, but more in your wheelhouse, certainly. And what transpired on Monday, we were live on the air when the word came that Medina had been stricken. And I mean, I think as we were leaving the air, my only description for the aftermath was going to be firestorm, and
a guy texted me actually with the term shitstorm, which made me actually chuckle at a comment the first time I've heard you say it on the air, where you said you actually said something to the effect of taking it up the ass on the air.
Well, that was in regards to owners and horse players having to foot the bill for everything. The two most put upon portions of the game's equation. But Sid, obviously it's 72 hours, almost 72 hours later, and news cycle things, they ebb and flow. But your thoughts and how you suggest, we internalize this and also, how to view it externally.
Well, I mean, you're at a ball game and you got guys in the bleachers, which I'm going to use as a Twitter example or social media. And I mean, it's just a normal reaction for, I've mentioned this before, the reaction from the masses, the people on Twitter, it's completely expected. They have every right to trash everybody. They're frustrated, they're angry. Everybody's angry. I mean, it's just, The response is completely expected. It's like Twitter is an area where you get onto your machine and you get a chance to scream and just you're by yourself in your room and you just start punching stuff up and you scream and it's a visceral reaction of people and people that love the sport and all this. They're tired and I totally sympathize with people's emotions concerning the matter. And all the response is, what it is. I mean, Baffert's put himself in this situation with some really sloppy results over the last I don't know what, year and a half or whatever, you know, the two things in California, one would justify, and I think the other one would opportunity. Then you go to Oaklawn with the lidocaine for gamine and charlatan, then you go to the Oaks with the betamethasone for gamine, and then you know, top it off with some cherry on the Derby with the positive for betamethasone positive for Medina Spirit. You know, I wrote a column in TDN. I said, unfortunately, I happen to really like this horse. Remember, I picked him to win at the British Classic.
Yeah,
he did.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, he was, to me, a super admirable horse just for the reasons I wrote in my column in TDN. You know, like, I noted how this phrase that Aidan O'Brien told me about Saxon Warriors, 2,000 guineas winner, he said he'd kill himself stone dead for you. Meaning, he was that type of rare horse that just laid it all on the line. And that's how this horse, Medina Spirit, was. It's unfortunate that when, you know, the responses from everybody was, you know, the derogatory stuff and innuendo about Baffert, but nothing about Medina Spirit. And I felt like I had to write something about Medina Spirit on here because, you know, people's first response is, you know, Baffert. So I did. You know, I also, you know, in the position I'm in, I know some of these people, and I know how what it's like for people when they lose horses. I actually sent the condolences text to Amr Zidane and Baffert. As I said in the column, Zidane responded within like 30 seconds with a praying symbol, and Baffert responded just one word, devastated. None of that is going to pacify any of the crowd, but, you know, these guys, they're not out there trying to kill their horses, you know. And it's a devastating thing to them as well. Unfortunately, as you pointed out, in terms of the entire game, it's just, you know, it's a freaking knockout punch, you know. So you have emotions of how racing is being perceived versus you have emotions about Baffert the Juicer. You have emotions about all his owners are assholes. And, you know, I'm not on Twitter making comments from the bleachers. I've got to write something that I think is what I feel about it, which is what I did. You know, I've also got this underground blog I started where I'm a little more looser with stuff. Try to explain to people, you know, some of the mechanisms behind it. But look, as you know, I've been in the baseball business, youth baseball, for a long time, and you know, followed my son from youth baseball all the way to professional baseball. I mean, you know, you're always going to get people. It's just part of any sport that they're just going to rip on you, and it's something that anybody who's in this business has got to get used to. I mean, I cringed the other day. I saw some guy had a video. He was following Brad Cox through the race course with a video yelling at him about what a juicer he is and stuff like that. I mean, you know, that's his right to do, and that's what people do. But, yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is seriously cringeworthy.
No doubt. You mentioned Sid, you referenced owners. How were owners supposed to react? I mean, I had Todd the other day to essentially, we were recapping the, you know, his big weekend. I want to talk to you about Mo Donegal. You know, and I asked him for his, you know, for his reaction. You know, that was 24 hours afterward, and he he did like a lot of people, doesn't have necessarily a ready pat answer. I brought up Life is Good and Following C. And he said, that he's done the best he can with them, and it's not the way he wants to acquire horses, essentially. We kind of touched on the ownership equation to a degree.
Yeah, those two horses were horses that were with Baffert that were switched right over to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Two very good horses. I mean, Life is Good as the horse that we did the mating for Gary and Mary West.
That's right. That's right.
And, there's no pat answer. And first and foremost, this horse dies. It's gut punch. It's a tragedy. I mean, it's a death of a horse, a death of a Derby winner. My first reaction, honestly, was like I said, I just felt, what a shame.
It's tragic.
Yeah. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy. And, it's always a shame when any horse dies. We forget that, or I do, because I've been in this game. I've been following racing for 45 years, and I'm probably too jaded through the years to be the proper person to talk with the proper level of shock or whatever, because I've been seeing it happening for so many years. Not to mention the fact that I've, through personal experience and stuff, in my early 20s, I was buying and selling horses. And I'd go to some of these small tracks, try to, because I'd look at pedigrees and mares or Suffolk or Waterford Park, which is Mountaineer. You got to buy some of these horses. And that's when I first really realized, you can buy some of these horses for like $200. And what's happened, the shock at that point that I had was that, oh, geez, these horses are being sold for $200. It's the exit part of the game where they go to slaughter. And that was a huge shock for me because I'd been a racing fan as a young teenager, went through high school and college, really an anomaly for a kid that age really to be into racing that much. And, when I got out, I started dabbling in it. And when I started realized I could buy these horses so cheap, I realized why, because from these small tracks, that was the exit for them. These horses were going to what guys at the time used to call the chop shop. I was like, oh my God, what? That was such a shock for me early on, and
sure,
through the years, it's just become accepted that, think about it, you're breeding 30,000, during that year of whatever, 40,000, 50,000 horses a year. Well, where they're all going? Well, they're slowly being sent to slaughterhouses and shipped to Canada and Mexico and even here at that time. And so, after a while, you just realize that part of this game, which is not in the mainstream, is this really, element of it. And so for me personally, I just became over the years so immune to it that at this point it just takes a Derby winner dying like the way he did to really, affect me. I mean, that's probably an insensitive way to put it, but, you know, ultimately, everybody in this business has to understand that, you know, you're dealing with animals. It's a life. It went from a livestock business to, you know, as we've talked about on this program, you know, people have become more the horse has sort of become like the dog, you know, become personalized as a friend, an animal, and it is, but, you know, it's taken on a level with racing, and so we tend not to look at the bottom parts of it, and we tend to, you know, celebrate the greatest parts of it, and, yeah, obviously, so when Medina Spirit dies, it really does affect everyone, but sometimes I have to remind myself that, you know, he's one of many horses dying in this game. It's never easy to even say that, but
no. You know. There, have you watched the Western series with Kevin Costner, this Yellowstone?
No, I haven't, but I heard good stuff about it.
It's you know, it's a modern Western. Taylor Sheridan, right. who did Hell or High Water and Wind River, is very good.
Yeah.
And there's a Jermaine. In the last couple of weeks, there was a Jermaine scene because they're ranchers and they're cattlemen. And
right.
As a vehicle to introduce a love interest to Kevin Costner, they bring, geez, I'm just looking down. It's the fattest squirrel I've ever seen in our yard. I mean, he looks, it is like a small raccoon. It's unbelievable. And it's only December. How did they, he's obviously preparing for a long winter.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a protest. They're protesting the cattlemen and you know, factory farming of you know, for meat. And Costner had a tremendous line that sort of wormed its way in the back of my brain, where he asks the protest leader, who he ends up ultimately sleeping with, but he asked the question, you know, what do you think happens when they plant the quinoa or whatever it is, you know, you eat? What about the mice and the worms and the other ecosystem portion that is disrupted by, you know, the growing of grain, for instance.
Yeah.
And he said,
yeah,
how cute does an animal have to be before you care about it dying so that you can eat?
Yeah, that's kind of poignant, isn't it?
In our context. And that's what's so disingenuous about these protests. And what always bothers me, and the, you know, these people that are lined up to attack the industry, and equine sport in general. And I said the other day, it's vital that all of us.
I heard that.
Right. This is not limited to thoroughbred racing, quarter horse racing, standardbred racing. It includes all equestrian, polo, all of us that are involved in any, you know, athletic endeavor involving the equine have to be unified in our message and in our resistance to people trying to dictate their sensibility. And what's so phony about it is that they think they're speaking for the animal, which is just preposterous in lieu of people whose entire lives and livelihoods are tied to the breeding, the the birth, the rearing, the care and maintenance of these animals, and that would be us, not them. And it's just laughable.
And they're not all vegans either.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and they're not, there better not be a piece of leather anywhere on their body, a shoe, a belt, a briefcase. I respect those that are all in, that won't eat anything that has a mouth and eyes, and you know, won't wear clothes, etc. But even that are made from animal. But at the same time, to go back to this scene in Yellowstone. I drove by a bunch of cotton fields between Tucson and Phoenix, and you know, some forms of animal life were disrupted in the planting and cultivation of those cotton fields. I suppose wool is without although maybe people feel that the sheep are embarrassed when they get shorn. Mm-hmm. Are we? Because let's face it, you know, they do look funny for a couple of months. I saw a bunch of them out at Arizona. In fact, at the agricultural center that I drove by, they got a big herd of sheep actually. Big herd. Anyway, all right. Sid, as always.
Mo Donegal.
Well, first of all, before we even get into Mo Donegal, what about the situation that finds Ashview and Santulli having bred both of these winners? It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. The Remsen and the Moiselle winners both are Ashview Santulli products.
Yeah, that was really a rarity, and it was, you know, such an unbelievable thing to have two, you know, potential Oaks and Derby starters,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Potential horses. Yeah, it was a great accomplishment. I noted that in my column, but there was, and it's been written about, and it should get the accolades, but as I was looking at that, it just dawned on me that Pletcher's third. And the big one, the grade one winner, American Revolution, was bred by Fred Hertrich and John Fielding. And would you believe this? They, or at least Hertrich, in partnership with Fielding, for most of them, but Hertrich particularly, has bred six grade one winners in 2021.
It's unbelievable.
From a small program at Watercress Farm.
It's amazing.
It's ironic because I go back to Watercress was originally owned by Dr. Phil McCarthy, a vet. It was a real good friend of mine, and Fred Hertrich, and this was years ago. And Dr. Phil, a lot of you might know him because he was a vet at Ashford, and he was the vet that was known as great reproductive vet, and that's where they sent Cigar, for example. And Cigar was at that farm, Watercress. And so Dr. Phil McCarthy and I was actually just reminded of this because after I wrote my column in TDN, Fred Hertrich sent me a real nice note. Actually, when I wrote it, I had put down 5 G1 winners, and Fred pointed out that there were actually 6, so I had to change it. Note this, it was 6 G1 winners. But Fred Hertrich and Dr. Phil, you know, they bred some great horses. Shamardal, for example, was bred by them. And Fred pointed out to me, he goes, you know, Sid, years ago, you might not remember this, and this dates the two of us, but you actually sold a couple of mares to me and Dr. Phil many, many moons ago. Must have been 30 years ago. So that was really funny. I had forgotten that because I'd been friends with, you know, Phil. I didn't really know Fred, but Phil used to tell me that his partner was a guy from the Standard Bird business, and that was Fred. So I got a really nice note from Fred after I wrote that, And really, I think Fred Hertrick should be in the discussion for an Eclipse Award, because that, notwithstanding what Ashew and Colesnick did, the fact that a small operation like Watercress can breed 6 G1 winners of 2021 is just an unbelievable accomplishment. Unbelievable.
You know, it's going to be hard. I wanted to go back, Sid, because I didn't vote for them last year, but I'm going to guess in 19. I've tried to get the two of them. I have voted. Yeah, I have voted for them. I'm just looking. 20. I didn't in 20. 19. I went with Godolphin, and it's going to be tough to stop Godolphin, I think, this year, based on that roster.
Yeah, Godolphin's been a juggernaut. But
yeah.
Sometimes, and we've talked about this before. You know, for years, when I was, 20, 30 years ago, I was at DRF, we had, for the breeding category, the way they did it was they had two representatives of DRF, and it was me, I was the Bloodstock editor, and Logan Bailey, who ran the Kentucky office of DRF.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Two people from, so we were the two from the forum, and then two from each of the other two organizations, and it was a committee of six. So two from each organization. And we did a much better job of this because it wasn't just on pure stats and volume and numbers. You know, and so you were able to give notable breeders, say, for example, voters will just look at, they've got progeny earnings, their horses have won, $1 million, but, they might have bred one grade, one winner, and then you get a Fred Hertrich that, maybe the progeny earnings weren't as much, but they bred six grade one winners, that kind of distinction you're able to have with people that know about the business and can parse the stats better than the general voting box. And in a situation like that, I think you're able to give the recognition to smaller entities that are deserving. And I think that's the case here, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's easy to go with Godolphin, but then you took a look,
right,
look at the volume of Godolphin, and I don't know how many grade one winners they've had this year in the United States, but they've had obviously Essential Quality, Mystic Guide. Did Mystic Guide win a G1 in this country? I'm not sure, but at any rate, he won
good
the Dubai World Cup. But I'm sure they've had quite a few. Shadwell is Malatat, right?
Yes.
At any rate, I don't know what the actual number is for Godolphin, but I can tell you that you're not going to get a more powerful yield grade one winners to, broodmare band than I'm thinking off the top of my head with Fred Hertrich and what he's done.
No, there's no question, and I'm just pulling up Godolphin. Let's see, Essential Quality. I'm not going to include the international. I guess you sort of have to a little bit. Your Beer, of course, and Space Blues, and Modern Games. But Maxfield, Walton Street did win it up at Woodbine. Altheca won the Diana. Wild Beauty and Albar win the Natalma in the summer. Who else is new? Caramel Swirl won the Raven Run. Michelina for Stidham won the Hillsboro. Pixelate for Stidham as well. There's Mystic Guide and the Razorback. Geez, here's one I don't even remember. Gershwin won the Penn Mile. My God.
I don't want to include the horses that were European raiders.
That's fair.
Because we're talking, you know, breeder, North American breeding.
And yes. Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Good point. As opposed to the win. Well, obviously on the owner's side, they're winning.
As owners, you can.
Yeah, the owner, they're winning.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Well, and I'm just looking. My last 4 years that of voting, I voted for Hertrick and Fielding third in 2018, where I voted for John Gunther, which, you know, was easy, well as Jane Lyon, Summer Wind, second. And also in 2017, actually 2017, I advocated for Live Oak for Mrs. Weber. I voted Hertrick Fielding second and Clear Sky third. Hertrick, Bessie Lou and Windstar somehow ended up as the other two finalists with Clear Sky. Clear Sky won. Which was not inappropriate at all, but I've tried this, Sid. It's not easy to get the appropriate recognition for operations like Hertrick Fielding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about Mo Donegal for a minute, and here's a Uncle Mo out of a pulpit mare, and
I do want to talk about Mo Donegal because I'm involved in this colt.
Oh, nice.
And that's why I want to mention him as well, because unlike a lot of the great, you know, these big ownership groups and syndicates and partnerships and whatnot, the Donegal partnership is small time compared to them, Jerry Crawford's operation.
Sure.
And, you know, somehow they keep getting relevant runners. And a lot of the credit goes to Jerry. Jerry always says the buck stops with him. And we're just a small part of his organization in the sense that Jerry comes to me first, us at WTC, because he's one of the few owner clients that we have that he's very, very specific in what he wants, and that is he wants 10 furlong horses only. Hmm. He said, that's what he wants, and so that's how we started for him. You know, we identified horses like, you know, Doulahan and, you know, all his good horses that he's had. Arklow, these are all horses that stay. And what happened with Jerry was that as the Derby point system changed and it took away, there was an onus on being able, suddenly, some of these horses of his were such late developing horses that they weren't now getting the points necessary even to get into the Derby. So Jerry and I had to talk about this, and we said, we need to cut this 10 furlong thing, this real severe stamina that you're always looking for, shorten it up to maybe 9, 9.5, so that you can get some action in some of these qualifying races to have a shot to get back into the Derby. And he had come to that realization as well. So that's why I wanted to bring up Mo Donegal. He was one of the horses we identified for him. And I just went back and I looked at my notes and I said what I'd sent him was 9.5 furlongs. And, you know, it's really great when you can sort of that horse like that way, and it kind of works out, you know. So this horse won the 9 furlong Remsen at 2, kind of puts it in that range already. And so really happy to see Jerry back, and particularly in this marketplace, Steve, what we've been talking about with all these big syndicates that we've mentioned, you know, forming these groups to buy Colts. So, you know, they're just sucking up all the best horses possible out there because they've got really smart people, you know, scouring the grounds, and they've got economies of scale now, you know, billionaires in partnership with billionaires buying this stuff. And so to be able to get, you know, a horse like Mo Donegal is really great because he was obviously one the bigger guys passed on. Now he cost $250,000. A similar situation, you know, happened with the West with Game Winner, who we'd identified, and Ben Glass was able to get him for $110,000 because there were some veterinary issues that other guys passed on, but his vet okayed it. So, you know, I think it's really important, as something you and I always talk about in this thing, that it's really important to be able to, for smaller entities to have a shot. Whether you're a gambler, as we're talking about, or a horse owner, or a breeder, or whatever, you know. And the Medina Spirit story is that it's a great story. Gail Rice bred backyard breeding program, bred this colt of a chief. A cheap stud fee, you know, and so, sold for $1,000 yearly, and $30,000. The two-year-old just happened to be in Baffert's barn, but he could have been in anybody. But, you know, these horses that the big guys aren't getting, I always celebrate because it's really a victory for the game in the end.
I'm looking at this pedigree. And there's a few things going on. I mean, stamina-wise, if you go all the way back, you go down the tail line, the Nureyev mare, Save the Last Dance, then the 49er mare, Sue's Last Dance, who, as it happens, got the second dam, the very good Island Sand that Larry, I remember Larry Jones, trained. Mike Ryan started Island Sand and started that's a filly that just got better and better and better. Won the Del Cap and won the Acorn. And her daughter, Calling Miss Brown, a modest winner by Pulpit. But there's plenty of stamina here. And then you get what Uncle Mo brings to the party. So this is a nice balanced pedigree here with stamina, with some speed. And
Why we had it like at a 9.5 furlong. And I'll tell you, one of the things early on, it was funny when Uncle Mo's first yearling drew at the sale, I mentioned to Jerry that I really did like Uncle Mo for, you know, a classic type of horses, but Jerry wasn't sold on Uncle Mo at the time. Of course, then Uncle Mo got Nyquist in his first crop, obviously won the Derby. And if you look at Nyquist's pedigree, there's a lot of speed in it. And when the female family... even when the female family was bred to stamina horses like AP Indy, for example, and Seeking the Gold and stuff like that, they still produce speed horses. So for that family to go to Uncle Mo and get a Derby winner, and Nyquist had a lot of speed, but it really showed that Uncle Mo, despite what he showed himself in the track, he was a man amongst boys at two, extremely fast horse for Pletcher, had some issues that kind of curtailed his three-year-old year, and he came away with a reputation really as a miler. But he, as a stallion, is different than what he was as a racehorse. He gets more staying ability. He puts more staying ability into his horses. And so that's one of the things you have to realize, that what a horse was as a racehorse isn't necessarily what he's going to be as a stallion. Uncle Mo is a really good example of that. And so in this particular pedigree, with Pulpit and Uncle Mo and what you just mentioned in the female family, it really made sense that this horse was a horse that was going to be able to stay, you know, and that's what he's showing right now.
We should also, because it, I don't want to short change Zandon either in here.
Heck of a performance by him. Yeah.
Terrific performance. Second career start only, and you know it's not as if you know MoDonegal was making his eighth start. It was his third
for him,
and only his second two turn. But for Zandon, I tell you what was to me was impressive was the fact that he was stretching, and the only reason I used him as a C in there, but I just wondered, going from 6 to 9 furlongs is really demanding, and so that part of it, yeah, exactly, and you know, and then you know he's upstart out of a Creative Cause mare, and so you just kind of just felt a little middle distancy to me, and I just thought it was a lot to ask essentially. But he ran great.
Heck of a performance, and also he covered more ground too in that race. You know,
yes.
So there's a lot of factors that go into making him look, you know, extremely well. You know, obviously there's this historical thing with the Remsen that you know it hasn't yielded this a lot in terms of classic prospects, and it's something actually that years ago Jerry and I talked about because he had. Won the same race with, I think it was Patio Prado. It wasn't Patio Prado, but it was an El Prado. Maybe it was Patio Prado. I forget.
That makes sense.
El Prado. Do you remember who he was? El Prado for Donegal. Let me just see here if I can look it up.
Yeah, I can pull it up too.
Yeah, it was an El Prado horse that Donegal won. Let me see. El Prado again, exactly. El Prado again won the Remsen for Jerry and
Dale.
You know, I remember talking to him about it back then. I said, you know, you got to be really careful. The two-year-old winning a 9 furlong race late in the year, and then how is he going to come back onto the Derby trail, especially in this climate? And, you know, he ended up going bad and didn't do it. So, you know. It doesn't mean that, you know, that's what, just because all that happened, that's what's going to be. I mean, there's always the exceptions to the rule. Hopefully, you know, Todd Pletcher and Jerry, and you know, they come up with a good plan for this colt, and hopefully he's an improving colt, as is Zandon, and, you know, the two of them, you know, hopefully turn the tables on this race around.
Well, Zandon, and I'm just looking at his page. Upstart, Creative Cause mare, who herself was out of an Indian Charlie mare, who was out of a Gone West mare, out of a Fappiano mare. So really, he's already having proven that the 9 furlongs is in his. Capability. It seems like he's already exceeded potential distance limitations at a glance.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to touch upon one other thing with Uncle Mo.
Yeah.
And that is, Uncle Mo is, this line goes back to Caro. And Caro is a European horse who was imported to the United States, the Spencer Farm, I think in like 1979. Leslie Combs brought him over. And this horse was, you know, a top European performer. He'd had success in Europe as a stallion. And this was during this period where there was a lot of importation taking place from Europe. So what happened was he was brought over, as was as were horses like Sharpen Up. You know, this was during a period when all these really great European horses were coming to stud here. Blushing Groom, you know, they were all coming and going to stud here. Nureyev, you know. And what happened with Carol was that, you know, he was a European horse from a odd branch of Nash Ruler to begin with. And he came over here, big gray horse. Of course, he got winning colors, won the Kentucky Derby. Got a lot of good sons, you know, Dr. Carter, Cozine, who ended up being a good stallion. But his line essentially died out here. And so when you look at Uncle Mo, he brings a really old bloodline that he's brought back. And it wasn't just him. It really started to come back with his sire, Indian Charlie. And Indian Charlie was California bred. He was trained by Bob Baffert. A brilliant horse, big horse, unsound. Got hurt, I think, in the Derby after he ran second, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the guy that took the shot on him, speaking of Zandon, was Brary Jones.
Brary Jones.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, Brary Jones had this profile of taking horses like these, some talented horses, without these glittering pedigrees, without these big sire lines, and giving them a shot. And, you know, so he brought Indian Charlie here. Indian Charlie became a really good stallion. You know, I think he went from, like, you know, 10,000 to 75,000, stuff, whatever, I can't remember. So that Baffert horse that was brilliant, but, you know, didn't have what most people would have taken. Airdrie took the shot on him, and he became a terrific stallion. Indian Charlie became really resuscitated this line. And it was because of that, Brary Jones taking that shot on Indian Charlie, that we have Uncle Mo. Because Uncle Mo is really the only good son at stud of Indian Charlie. And so it's ironic how things work, right?
Absolutely.
So suddenly there's this new sire line, quote, it's really an old one, but it's an oddball one for the United States. And it's because of this Indian Charlie getting an opportunity in Kentucky and then able to get a sire son even better than he was. And that's Uncle Mo. And, you know, it's funny. The funniest thing was early on I was talking about Baffert, and I said, you know, you trained Indian Charlie. How come you never buy any Uncle Mo's? And that was because Baffert said, you know, Indian Charlie was really unsound. He's a big, unsound horse, brilliant, fast, but, you know, he just figured that with Uncle Mo's own soundness issues at three, he kind of stayed away from Uncle Mo. But Uncle Mo has proven to be, you know, the real deal. And what's great is that now Uncle Mo's first sons, as we've talked about, and you've actually bred to a son of Uncle Mo, Nyquist, the late Hailband, Outwork, yeah, they all came out firing. And so it looks like what was an end of a sire line has been totally resuscitated, and it's adding a lot of diversity to the American breeding industry.
Well, and what a perfect note as we wind down, Sid, because I've got a couple of other things here on the desk to quickly slip in, and that includes Mo Forza, who is going to stand at Rancho San Miguel for TaylorMade, and I would imagine is going to be very well received. And what's unique about Mo Forza, of course, is the presence of unusual heat, the unusual heat mare, and everything that Barry Abrams, every California breeder that loved and respected Barry, I think will want to cover one of their mares with Mo Forza just to have a piece of, of Barry to cling to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He's a horse that was ouchy and had to be very, very carefully, managed. Mm-hmm. and made the most of. But I imagine he's going to be, there'll be a real interest in him. A big, good-looking horse.
He's a grade one winner, isn't he?
Huh?
He's a grade one winner, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And Unusual Heat is by Nureyev. And as you pointed out, in Mo Donegal, you've got that Nureyev in there, too.
What's also interesting, you talk about the Unusual Heat mare, who's out of an Afternoon Delights mare, who's out of a Ms. Wacky mare, who's out of a Minstrel mare. I mean, there's no telling what boxes Mo Forza will tick with mares. Yeah. It could be a bonanza. He could be the new Unusual Heat long term.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should also mention, and another segue, Sid, before we wrap up, Airdrie Stud bringing in Bo Liam, we should note.
Yeah, that's, again, a typical type of, a horse you normally wouldn't think so, but, Barry Jones knows what he's doing, and this is a Liam's Map. Liam's Map is... talk about sire lines that look like they're about to end, and suddenly there's a rejuvenation, and in this case it came from Liam's Map, the son of Unbridled Song, who we happen to do the mating for ourselves, too.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and we did that for Alba Family Trust, but it looked like as they were winding down with these great sons of Unbridled Song, it looked like everything was going to hang on in the balance on how Arrogant did.
Right, that's right.
Arrogant died, but it's Liam's Map now, who's already got four Grade One winners. Two of them, by the way, out of Bernardini Mare. Has a great record with AP Indy. And so suddenly there's now newfound interest in another generation of that, which possibly could carry the sire line of Unbridled Song that looked like it was going to just fall flat. To another level. Liam's Map is the horse that's ending up being the carrier of Unbridled Song.
We covered all the bases.
I think so.
That was great.
Yeah.
That was great. And came full circle as always. You, of course, can reach Sid, Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. You heard a legacy of success conversation here about any number of Work Thoroughbred Consultant products, 510-490-1111. It's getting down to decision time over the next little while, of course, and frankly, we're only 2.5 weeks away from new babies. There's going to be fuzzy foals and some first babies to look forward to here in just a couple of weeks. Sid, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Great talking, and we'll speak next week.
You got it. Sid Fernando, everybody. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. We'll take a break, our only break of the morning, because we've got Joe Applebaum, the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. Joe's going to join us next. We're going to check in with Pat Cummings, who is lingering in Tucson. One more morning in Tucson, but I wanted Pat to follow up the things we talked about on Tuesday. And then Seth Merrow and I will get a post-scratch look at this $87,000 pick-six carryover at the Big A, as racing resumes in New York for just a couple more weeks and then a little break. coincides pretty closely with what we're going to break for Christmas as well. Back after this at the races, Sirius XM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.